The 1997 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 291, Pillars of My Faith, with J. Frederick Toby Pingree, Karen Anderson England, and Dale LeChaminade.
I'd like to welcome everybody to this session of the Sunstone Symposium, The Pillars of My Faith. We're going to begin this evening by singing a hymn, but the program tonight is going to be a little bit different than is printed. We're privileged to add Wayne Booth as a speaker tonight. He's going to go in, and we're going to change the order of the hymn, so everybody's going to need to pay attention. I told Ardeen Watts that I was going to leave how many verses we sing up to him. It's at his discretion, and he said as long as we're charging along, he's going to keep it up, but if there's no energy, he's going to cut it off. So we're changing the order of the program, as I stated earlier. Dale LeChaminade is going to be our first speaker. Dale LeChaminade spent 32 years at the University of Utah Institute of Religion. He was the associate director there. He has a BA in economics, an MA in literature, and a PhD in the cultural foundations of education. He is the father of five children. His wife, Wanda, I asked how he would like to be introduced, and she said, he's a good guy. And we'll proceed to the program from there.
I asked to go first, but I'm not sure that was a smart thing to do, following Ardeen Watts. But just tough. Before my brief remarks on Pillars of My Faith, I want to offer two kudos and make a confession. The first goes to the Enterprise of Sunstone, a lion in the den of Daniels. It was not supposed to be funny. Which at its best has provided an outlet for Mormons to freely express their inmost selves. An important but risky business because someone may misunderstand what is said or misconstrue what is intended. The second to Albert Peck, persistent, patient, committed director of this enterprise, who with his staff has carried on faithfully under trying circumstances. Encore. Finally, a confession. Since I don't trust myself to extemporize on this important topic, there's too little time and too much temptation to ramble. I have compressed my ideas into a paper, much of which I will read, yet another risky venture fraught with the danger of your becoming bored. Let me suggest a true and tried approach that will ensure we end my part of this session together. First, listen very carefully to see if what I have prepared is sufficiently interesting to engage your minds. Second, if it isn't, then quietly think of what you would say on the topic, and in either case, you'll be satisfied. I wish to be clear, for clearness is next to godliness, I'm told. And writing down ideas is how I clarify them best. I have been intrigued for years with an idea expressed by the late columnist Sidney Harris, concise thinker and wordsmith. He wrote, "To be educated is to understand the implications of one's beliefs." So tonight, following Harris's lead, I will tell you of my personal education. That is to say, how the implications of my beliefs have influenced my thinking on several crucial issues of religion. I alone am responsible for the implications I have drawn, though I do owe a debt of gratitude to those mentors here and to those gone who contributed to my thinking with information, insights, and encouragement offered at the right time. To them I give my thanks. The central pillar of my faith is faith itself, specifically faith in people both mortal and divine, and in our shared destiny. This assurance sustains me from day to day as I venture with hope into the future, where I trust there will be interesting, worthwhile, and endless possibilities for creative, free choices in association with others, you and others. Living such a life of faith is the essence of eternal progression. For me, a fundamental idea of Mormonism not to be compromised. However, we have adopted into our Mormon language from Christian thought the so-called omni words, omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence, which allegedly denote God's perfect knowledge and power in the extent of his being, and presumably our nature when we attain godhood. Yet if one believes in the eternal personal progression of man and of God, as I do, these omni words simply have no useful place in the Mormon lexicon of theological terms unless these terms are qualified as B.H. Roberts did in his 70s course in theology. Some of our thinkers, James Talmage, John Widsoe, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and others, have publicly taught the concept of eternal progression for man and God. Their teachings, though now out of favor, are to be easily found in the literature just for the reading. The fact is, omnipotent is the only omni word used in Scripture in just 7 times, once in the book of Revelation and 6 times in King Benjamin's sermon in the Book of Mormon. And then to express the writer's devotion to God rather than his definition of God's nature. I find that to be aware of the tone of a passage of Scripture, that is, the writer's feeling for his subject, helps me to determine his initial intention and to avoid misusing the passage. For many, the purpose of this life is to prepare for entering the celestial kingdom. We scurry to attend meetings, fill assignments, and complete projects, all requirements of the church to build the present earthly kingdom. To these are added temple marriage toward rearing a sizable family, education to some practical end, work in a satisfying vocation to earn sufficient money to do what is needed. All emphasize doing prescribed activities. We Mormons are inveterate doers. You will remember the famous sign reported to have been on President Kimball's desk, "Do it." However, I find encompassing these acts, important as they certainly are, a more comprehensive and far-reaching vision, as indicated in Jesus' statement on his ministry, quote, "I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly," end quote. All the aforementioned deeds are subsumed under the concept that life's purpose can be to continuously and creatively embrace all the physical, spiritual, mental, and social aspects of eternal existence, and by this to realize our expanding potential. I fully subscribe to this concept because I think it is grounded in the fundamentals of Mormon thought on man and God. Furthermore, I think it is incumbent upon us as free souls to do just what we earnestly desire within gospel parameters, to define and best achieve the abundant life for ourselves. This would include, but go far beyond, the necessary church requirements I've mentioned. We all have such widely differing personal avenues to what gives our lives meaning, and we should. The idea of personal freedom to choose our paths to open-ended growth may seem far too abstract, overly idealized, and disturbingly vague, even frightening, for we would be left with a plethora of decisions about what to do with our lives. This could be seen as risky and uncertain. And so it is said, the safe life and the perpetuation of the church, I might add, comes from our doing dutifully the prescribed activities, almost according to a prepared script. My bishop isn't here. Keep in mind, we are taught that we have the potentiality to become gods. We anticipate someday in the far reaches of eternity We will become gods in the perfected state of omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence, and so bring our personal growth to a final closure. When perfection is assured, there will remain nothing left to accomplish. I confess such a goal holds no allure for me. There would be no learning, no tasks to labor over, no problems to solve, no questions to ask or answer, no striving, no yearning, no anxious engagement in a good cause, nothing to anticipate. A sterile stasis in a far distant time, devoid of all that gritty stuff of this present life that makes for high adventure. I say to come to this surreal state is an unnerving prospect. I have faith that the abundant life is the ongoing experience of becoming. Intriguingly, but ironically, described by Brigham Young, that supreme man of action whose labors we have celebrated through the sesquicentennial, quote, "To me, life would signify an extension. I have the privilege of spreading abroad, of enlarging my borders, of increasing in endless knowledge, wisdom, and power, and in every gift of God. All things that have come within the bounds of man's limited knowledge, the things he naturally understands, teach him that there is no period in all the eternities wherein organized existence will become stationary, that it cannot advance in knowledge, wisdom, power, and glory." I do like Brigham's expansive idea. I pause to make a brief but important aside about how I am most effectively motivated toward the abundant life. We find in ancient and modern exhortations an ever-present prick to our conscience to avoid at all costs the frightful effects of sin. I have said to college students that these somber warnings seem designed to literally scare the hell out of us. But, of course, I wouldn't say that tonight. Matthew Arnold, 19th century British man of letters, in an essay entitled Hebraism and Hellenism, wrote that this strictness of conscience comes from our Hebraic roots. My, we do have a lot of Old Testament on our Mormon bones, I think. However, Arnold reminds us that we have yet another vital tradition from Hellenism, our Greek legacy, which he calls a spontaneity of consciousness, an awareness of an attraction to a self-fulfilling life through right thinking and right living. This reminds me of Jesus saying, quote, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me," end quote, in which, I believe, he referred not only to the effects of his resurrection, but also to his loving personal appeal to beckon us to a higher experience of thinking and living. Jesus' love and radiant example is a far more effective motivation for me than the dark fear of sin's dire consequence. We think of John's declaration, "Perfect love casteth out fear." In a well-known passage from the Pearl of Great Price, I find an additional statement of God's purpose. Quote, "This is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man." Key terms, immortality and eternal life, signify two aspects of the abundant life to which Jesus draws us: a resurrection into a higher physical state of being beyond death, and in that state, the possibility of attaining a still higher spiritual quality of life, not just an endless existence on a flat plane, but an ever-expanding enrichment in every way. This statement of God's purpose implies that we are of immense value to him. Admittedly, that sounds pride and egocentric, but to believe that God does care for us and that we merit his caring helps me to see our worth through God's eyes and hence to be more fully appreciative not only of myself but of others as well. Moreover, seriously taken to heart that we are of intrinsic worth to God can be a powerful corrective to self-denigration and to sin. While we have been told that pride cankers the soul, I observe self-disparagement to be equally damaging. It just isn't as conspicuous as the proud regard oneself. Certainly we are in the muck and mire of a world that offers every opportunity for discouragement and moral corruption. But I reject out of hand the Calvinistic doctrine, wherever it appears, that man is naturally depraved, arguably the worst idea that ever infected the human mind, as it was put by one of our writers. In stark contrast stands the premise that we are offspring of God, possessed of a natural endowment that resonates with the drawing power of Jesus urging us on to a higher life. Once again, we hear Brigham Young at his optimistic best. Quote, "It is fully proved in all the revelations that God has ever given to mankind that they naturally love and admire righteousness more than they do evil. The natural man is of God. He is the noblest work of God, and was in his creation designed for an endless duration, for which the love of all good was incorporated in his nature. It was never designed that he should naturally do and love evil." This rings true to me. It speaks to me. It helps me connect with others. To think well of people, to look for the good in them, to judge them at their best, I find liberating. I served in the armed forces with a few scoundrels whose lives were in moral disarray. But despite their loose lifestyle, in the worst, I sensed a flicker of goodness and a reason to have hope for them. Some people would find my optimism impractical and blind to the realities of human nature. My answer to this: Jesus was optimistic, but he too understood that mankind can be perverse, and so directed his disciples as they went into the world, "I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." That is, don't be foolish and naive. In our modern setting, one rendering of this caution might be, don't get ensnared in questionable get-rich schemes. Be cautious, careful, prudent. But even then, with all the treachery abroad in the land, I still find that to have prudent trust in people helps them to become more trustworthy and me to become more trusting. That strengthens me against cynicism and skepticism in my relationship with others. While I am disappointed on occasion, such as when I drive on I-15, I have not become pessimistic over my fellow man. Just two more important implications of my faith in people, both man and God, and I am finished. As I go about my life and as I learn of others' experiences, I have come to believe that we here tonight, we Mormons, surely do not have a monopoly on God's interests. Chosen, as we use the word in the phrase, the chosen people, means called to serve God, not privileged to be served by him. I take it as a given fact that God loves all of his children impartially. He glories with those who live fully as he suffers with those who take the broad, more traveled road. But he does not love less those who go astray. We might, he does not. I have quoted several of God's revelations to his chosen people found in our scripture, but there are other revelations than those which bespeak his concern for people everywhere and in all times. He desires them all to know him as they are able. The Book of Mormon prophet Nephi foresaw a future day when there would be opposition to other revelations than those in the accepted texts. The Lord is represented as correcting that self-sufficiency. Quote, "I command all men, both in the east and in the west and in the north and in the south and in the islands of the sea, that they shall write the words which I speak unto them. For out of the books which shall be written, I will judge the world, every man according to their works, according to that which is written. I shall speak unto all nations of the earth, and they shall write it." There are additional statements about God speaking to his children in a First Presidency's white paper. There is acknowledged the belief that God reveals himself to many through history, including the religious leaders and philosophers. One last step in my education. It is my belief that people are personally capable of learning the truth both about life's deepest issues as well as the most mundane everyday matters. Counsel increasingly comes to us to seek truth on all matters from the Spirit. I believe that. It's good advice. And I try to be prepared at all times to ask for and receive that help to confirm my decisions after I use all the available resources to do my part in seeking the truth. I think about possibilities. I seek the ideas of good and competent people, for example, the mentors I've mentioned, and I carefully evaluate their counsel. Yet I do hear the caution that not to rely on the arm of flesh, either my own or others. This warning raises a serious question about the dependability of my judgment, and I ask, if I cannot trust myself to make correct choices, how can I be sure that I can select another to do that for me? Good question, that. Regardless of whose voices I listen to, be they from prophets, pundits, or the Spirit, I cannot unburden myself of the responsibility for my choices. Inescapably, it is a personal matter to choose for myself or to choose someone to do that for me, and in either case to stand on the decision. I have heard good friends in the faith actually say that if certain people advise them to act or believe in a particular way, as a result of which an enterprise fails, they can justifiably shift to their advisors that responsibility for those actions and beliefs. I question such a proposition because it negates the fundamentals of progress that we accepted in a pre-earth existence, to make free and informed choices and to assume the responsibility for the results. To get on in life by letting someone else do our thinking and make our decisions is a tragic retreat from reality and is doomed to failure simply because it won't work. Moreover, to try to relieve us from the burden of thinking and deciding on our own is downright destructive of character. I must rely on my own capability to gather information from many sources, to seek counsel from reliable help, including God's Spirit, to think about possibilities and to act. It is my obligation to do so. In conclusion, I have told you briefly tonight how certain beliefs have influenced my life, but I continue to ponder their implications and ask myself if I believe in man's intrinsic goodness and capability for self-determination, God's love and concern for all his children, life's open-ended possibilities. I say, if these are my true beliefs, just how should they further affect my life as it unfolds? I'm still endeavoring to see more clearly their implications and to act wisely. And so my education goes on.
I'd like to thank Dale for his remarks. Dale's son, David, is a good friend of mine. I've known him for a number of years, yet tonight is the first night that I've met his parents. And through our association, I've heard him speak of his parents often, and he has always spoke very highly of them and held them in great esteem, and it's nice for me to be able to catch a glimpse of just why that's so. Our next speaker this evening is going to be Karen Anderson England. Karen is the former English department chair at Utah Valley State College. She has a PhD. She lists herself as a student in creative writing. She has a PhD in creative writing.
I'm a PhD student.
She's a PhD student at the University of Utah in creative writing. She describes herself as an essayist. She is the mother of four. Following Karen, we will sing "Shall We Gather by the River."
Haunted microphone. 2 months ago, my aunt Elaine Anderson Bateman, mother of 12, age 52, died of cancer. The 3 years she fought the disease were the last of her already difficult life. If God is, peradventure, counting righteous souls among us, postponing our destruction for the sake of 45 or 30 or 20 or 10, our peril has deepened since her departure. I loved my Aunt Elaine in a way not exactly like I have ever loved anyone else. Tonight, in order to make my comments most positive, most uncynical, most indicative of the part of me that yearns for harmony and charity, I will speak as if she yet stood among us and as if she could hear me, because that is what she did for all of us who knew her. She made us good. I dislike that Old Testament God who still rages through the Mormon church. A man in our gospel doctrine class explained a while ago that the God of the Old Testament was reassuring to him that the black and white quality of good and evil in the Old Testament, with its definitive rewards and punishments, seemed to be more of what we need in our wishy-washy times. While I was on my mission in Georgia, one bishop explained his disregard for our seeking out the inactive members of the church. One of these days, the church has just got to clear out the deadwood, he said. How can we get anywhere dragging all that extra weight around? My grandmother disdained a mugwump, a legendary and clearly unwieldy bird who kept its mug on one side of the fence and its wump on the other, never committing to either side. I think Grandma would have the good sense to love me anyway, even if she knew I had become one of those reprehensible creatures. And I'm not just fence sitting. I like to sit on whole junctions, big intersections, surveying several possible paths and positions, gaping round and round. Juanita Brooks wrote about riding herd, staying out of the dust and confusion of the cattle drive, but staying close enough to see the progress, note the landscape. I'd like to say that I'm riding right there alongside Juanita, but I don't manage the horses well. I keep getting dumped on my wump. My profession and my rather uncategorical personal life continually put me in the path of people who ask, "Are you a Mormon?" Or sometimes, "Are you a Mormon?" Or, "Are you a Mormon?" I dislike that question with any emphasis. It's not one of those black and white things. I'm temperamentally well-placed in this wishy-washy world. Yeah, but I'm deadwood is one possible answer. Ethnically, yes, is another. Indisputably, ethnically Utah-Idaho Mormon with one refreshing strain of German Lutheran. No is an increasingly simple and personally gratifying response. Yes, all by itself remains painful and dubious. But yes, regardless of the footnotes, must be part of my answer, at least to those whom I respect, those to whom I care to give of myself in any degree. When I was a student attending Eugene England's Mormon literature course, someone asked about Virginia Sorensen. Maybe it was me. "Is she still a Mormon?" was the question. Jean's answer struck me hard. It wasn't an answer. It was another question. "What do you mean by Mormon?" Jean queried. None of us could answer. We knew suddenly that our definitions of Mormon had been too narrow. And by realizing this, I began to think seriously about ways to live comfortably, or even uncomfortably, within its circumference. Not necessarily because I want to, as Paula Poundstone would explain, but because, for all practical purposes, I have to. I have to, because this is where I live, not just geographically, but in my imagination. Flannery O'Connor, one author who has helped me confront the perplexities of growing up in a highly distinctive culture, explains, "The things we see, hear, smell, and touch affect us long before we believe anything at all. And the South, I say Utah, impresses its image upon us from the moment we are able to distinguish one sound from another. By the time we are able to use our imaginations for fiction or for anything else constructive, we find that our senses have responded irrevocably to a certain reality. This discovery of being bound through the senses to a particular society and a particular idiom is for the writer the beginning of a recognition that first puts his work into real human perspective for him. My imagination, regardless of my wishes, is defined in this life by my Mormon upbringing. That's not entirely tragic. It follows that my best imaginings are in some way attributable to my Mormonism. I suppose they are the pillars of my faith. Let's call them tent poles. I can imagine a pretty huge tent, canopy style, nice open sides, good views, and easy access to the beckoning forests, crooked pathways, and seductive deserts outside. Great for occasional shade and shelter, familiar company, reorientation, held up by the tent poles of my faith. It marks a circle that defines my slovenly wilderness, like Wallace Stevens' anecdotal jar, whether I happen to be standing at any given moment inside or outside its periphery. Right now I stand outside, but within arm's reach of the canopy. I might like to wander further, but standing just inside is my husband, Mark, whose company I value. I'd hate to reduce Mark to a tent pole, but I could say he's holding one of the shaky ones up for me. Mark's faith is strange and strong, a strain which some who wish the tent smaller and cozier might not want to draw in. Mark's faith is one which simply won't let him conceive of himself as anything but Latter-day Saint, anything but artist, anything but questioner, pusher, and puller. Maybe the reason his pole is so wiggly is that he's always pulling it out, stretching the cloth, widening the circle. But his grip is firm, and his feet are sure. His faith is, for all of his wishes to speak freely and passionately of it to anyone near enough to hear him, actually a deep and silent wellspring, a jagged desert sentinel, vision far more than language. I catch glimpses of the truth he sees because I live with his art, a universe weird and eclectic, fluid in time, obliquely and rhythmically beautiful, inexplicable but valuable, brought to unity by the hand of a creator willing to transcend the merely apparent. My own forays into the non-apparent are often frightening excursions into flailing cluelessness. At some point, after the birth of my first child, maybe because everything mattered so much more as a result of her arrival than I ever imagined possible, maybe because I changed chemically and physiologically, something at the foundation snapped. Emily Dickinson, who had no children that I know of, was kind enough to describe it for me. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service, like a drum, kept beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creep across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and I in silence, some strange race, wrecked solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. To me, this is a very scary poem. Dickinson's poems, of course, lend themselves to various interpretations, but my reading of this one describes the death of naive certainty, an encounter with sheer, cold, existential terror. If I have an identifiable spiritual gift, it is a frightening one, a gift for comprehending non-existence, the brute power of absurdity, the reality of chaos, the possibility of ultimate annihilation of memory and consciousness. Ancient Norse mythology strikes a cold shaft in me. The belief that life and beauty, intelligence and charity are defeatable and most likely will be. I don't want to dwell on this or begin to guess at my own psychology in relation to such vision, but a cold black vacuum sucks always lightly at the back of my neck. Loss, irretrievable, and its implications as I let myself love hovers around my shoulders like a dream at the edge of memory. How can this be a gift? It makes light most precious. As planks in reason have broken for my flailing for a world to land on, I have searched for a single thing to know, a foundation on which to mend the planks and rebuild. Perhaps we all find our grace eventually, our irreducible premises, our sources. My knowing stands right now on my love for my children. My friend Sam, one person who seems to share my bleak endowment, assures me that maternal love is a biological phenomenon, a necessary natural occurrence necessary for the survival of the race. Another friend assures me that the birth of each child in this overpopulated world brings our demise all the closer. Those things may be. Such information makes the plank slippery, but I choose to stand here, gravel up my boots on its greasy surface, and keep my balance. I love my children, not perfectly, not without misgivings, not without cost. But I love them better than anything else I do, and my love for them is good, a good thing in a sea of inexplicability and absurdity. My small choice to love my children gives me confidence to choose to love beyond them, to love my husband, to love my father, maybe even to love my cranky colleagues, eventually to love beyond motive and requite. I haven't finished knowing then, not quite. My baby daughter's fat little cheeks are no illusion. I touch her cheeks, therefore I am. Therefore she is. She may be temporary, but her existence, however brief it may be in galactic time, has altered the universe. The rightness of her existence, and therefore of all of ours, is for me unquestionable. If we go down in disaster, go out with a whimper, flicker away like the last match in a cold black cave, I'm glad we were, all of us, here for a while. And I hope for even more. I hope for more life. I hope for redemption. I hope that I get enough time with the people I love, and there are many, that all my stupid mistakes will fade into triviality. I hope that 11th grade, for example, becomes a much smaller and less significant proportion of my existence. I'd like to minimize a few dates, a lot of sarcasm, some terrible marital episodes. I hope to see Utah Lake purified of its foulness, to see the sand of its shallow bed glittering below the perfect water, to touch the shining resurrected trout. I hope to stand on Lone Peak with my sons and daughters, at once children and adults, mortal and immortal, taking in eons, winter, spring, summer, fall, pristine and civilized. I'd like to take a dip, stark naked, in Lake Bonneville. I hope to live on a planet without a single hamburger franchise, a solitary billboard. I hope that orange poppies, spindled columbines, glacier lilies, lilacs, solstices, eclipses, meadowlarks, magpies, red sandstone, white granite, runoff water, ice caves, dinosaurs, petroglyphs, water snakes, elk, penguins, rope swings, fresh basil, acoustic instruments, Jeep Wranglers, strawberry ice cream, iced mocha lattes, Mexican beer, the entire West Utah desert, garden tomatoes, Gruyere cheese, and homemade bread, to name a few, last forever and ever. I hope my Andy Lane will live again, here with us. I hope her mentally disabled daughter, just my size and build, a second child as I am, grieving without phrase or comprehension, seizes words to greet her mother and tell her wisdom. I hope someday to meet my mother's mother, dead at 33. I hope to see the way she walks, hear the rhythms of her speech, catch a movement that her daughter kept and maybe passed on to me and my sisters, never knowing its source. I hope my parents become my age again, and that I get to be young and strong and 5 inches taller. I hope to see my Grandma Anderson pick up one of the arguments we left unfinished, show her I'm a little smarter now, show her my amazing kids, and somehow, miraculously, climb her backyard locust tree again. I hope the graves of my grandfathers, of Flannery and Juanita and Emily, of the Jews killed in Europe and the Indians killed in America, slaves and masters, Missourians and Mormons, men and women of mountain meadows, of all who were killed and of all who killed, will open up and relinquish their sorrows. Gertrude Stein said, considering how dangerous everything is, nothing is frightening. I suggest, considering how unlikely everything is, nothing is implausible. These things could be true. Occam, the razor man, recommended that good thinkers accept the most likely explanation for any given evidence. My 4-year-old son Porter, at least as credible, defies him. But Mom, maybe there are popsicles in the mailbox. Maybe we could make a real rocket and get in. Maybe Grandma Annie is coming right now, and maybe it's my birthday. Maybe this world, our slender threads of goodness, our little flickers of choice and existence, are immortal things. Maybe our tragedies and mistakes can be softened. Maybe grief can be balanced eternally by joy. Maybe there's even something or someone we can call God and speak with reverence, who will save Gomorrah for all our sakes, who comprehends our shades of gray and all the hues and tones besides. Whether or not I can ever finally believe that the promise of Christ's atonement can be fulfilled, I do believe that the principles his name represents are the only possible salvation for the hungry, humiliated, violent, and hopeless inhabitants of this world. And so, though I rarely embody them, I believe in the efficacy of tolerance, peace, charity, patience, and selflessness, even among those with whom we are most familiar, even toward those with whom we most adamantly disagree. And if we in this world vanish tomorrow, if our souls are obliterated with our bodies, if our sun burns away and turns to vile black ice, our love mattered all the more, as Matthew Arnold has pointed out more eloquently than I, because that was all we had. I dreamed a while ago that I was a child flying in a tiny airplane with a little boy, someone I loved and took for granted. Maybe I was Amelia and Christian, my inseparable 2 oldest children. Maybe I was Mark and me. We flew, wondering, spiraling through a vast space, peeking through pillars into various rooms, brushing against walls as high as we could see, gradually moving upward until we reached the ceiling. Paint peeled off its surface to reveal the marbled blue paper that Mark uses to signify the starry universe in his little box constructions. One wing tipped to brush the top, and a trap door opened. Out we flew into the glittering night, looking back at the diminishing, floating cathedral that we had once perceived to be the whole of space. I think my tent will diminish in the same way as I expand the circumference of my charted wilderness. The canopy will blow away to reveal the open sky. I will see the poles, which held it up were made from the larger world around it, that the landscape itself is structure and shelter enough. The circle will stand like an ancient ruin, memorial and microcosmic, as all mortal structures finally must. I happen to believe that Emma Smith, good with words, helped her husband Joseph craft the remarkable, the remarkably concise set of statements which became the Mormon Articles of Faith. I personally wouldn't mind an even more ruthless editing. The 13th holds up the doctrinal section of my breezy tent just fine. We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men and women and children and other creatures, may I add. Indeed, we may say that we follow the admonition of Paul. We believe all things, maybe I delete that line, we hope all things, we have endured many things and hope to be able to endure all things. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. For all my speculations here, I'm a bottom liner at heart. I plan for the worst possibility, then hope to be pleasantly surprised. This little article seems to be a fine plan for disaster and a good one for pleasant surprises as well. Regardless of how all this life spins out, we have the choice to seek after the lovely and to make it lovelier, for a while at least. I value the choice. Frightening as this could be, I want to worship a God who will risk leaving our existence and redemption up to us, who is powerful enough to make that possible, kind enough to make it possible forever, and once in a while, bail us out. And this is enough. Amen.
Our next speaker this evening is Wayne Booth. He is a professor emeritus from the University of Chicago. Is the recipient of many honorary degrees, author of many articles, describes himself as the father of two children, married to a wife for some odd years.
I won't tell.
She's a psychotherapist. He mentioned he has two grandchildren who are Jewish, and I said I'd let him explain that.
Well, after those two marvelous talks and two hymns, I'm inclined to say, in conclusion, I would like to thank you all for my being here and then go away. Some of you have the impression that I'm here tonight because I forgot to come for my speech yesterday. Well, as a hypocritical ex-missionary, I have a confession to make. I'm here because I planned it this way. When I received the program, my feelings were deeply hurt because I was not scheduled for a plenary. That's supposed to be a joke. I mean, so I decided to do something about it. This is all written out, something about it. If I didn't show up on Thursday, I could talk Elbert into making up for it like this. So, Elbert, thank you for the second time tonight. Quite a shock yesterday when I was sitting revising my talk to suddenly discover at 2:30 that I should have been speaking at 11 o'clock yesterday morning. One of my big handicaps here is not only that I have a manuscript like everybody else tonight, but that the podium is too low. Are you hearing me all right? Can everybody at the back hear okay? I had trouble hearing today in this room some, so if you can't, are you having trouble? Okay. For about 60 years now, I've been conducting a dialogue with my teenage self, who was a devout Orthodox believer. His line with me runs something like this: "You're betraying our grandparents and great-grandparents. You're casting aside the very testimonies that I have borne in fast meeting at least 20 times already. You'll make it so we'll not be allowed to talk with any of the family in the next world. Even though you list yourself as a Mormon and who's who, you're not a Mormon anymore. And so on he goes. After more near curses like that, off he rides on his bicycle to go to a Boy Scout meeting or to collect fast day donations or to remind the other boys in his quorum that they've got to be there 100% or the other quorum will win with their 100%. Sometimes I can manage to entice that young man, that boy, into a real discussion about what beliefs we still share together. My claim is, in those discussions, is that he and I still share the most important Mormon truths, the ones that are most truly religious, the sort of thing that the first two speakers were stressing in different ways. We cannot assume that every Mormon has the same beliefs, but we all share deep down many beliefs. That radical claim continues to disturb the boy. I don't see how you can make that claim, and I don't see how we can even discuss it. When you arrogantly reject what I know to be true, I just don't want to talk to you. Well, as I've talked not just with that young fundamentalist, but with various enemies and many of my other selves, as Karen just did over the years, I've been learning the kind of rhetorical practice that these days I risk labeling with a neologism, which I'm sure a lot of people will think disgusting, rhetorology. You know, when sociology was invented, everybody was upset, and when biology was invented, everybody was upset by why logy on the end of the name. Well, I'm inventing rhetorology, not mere persuasion with rhetoric, but rather a systematic ecumenical probing of the essentials shared by rival rhetorics in any dispute, including the rhetorics of believing Mormons and non-believing ex-Mormons and anti-Mormons, whether about religion or about other important matters. Rhetorologists, under whatever name, do not, and sometimes they're called dialogists or pluralists or whatever, do not just try to discover the rival basic commitments and then bargain, nor do they just tolerate in a spirit of benign relativism. Instead, they search together for true grounds, then labor to decide how those grounds dictate a change of mind about the more superficial beliefs. Now, the pursuit of that kind of listening and the resulting dialogue has become to me in itself a vocation that could be called religious, a kind of faith in the ultimate mission of improving dialogue about shared fundamental values. It's a mission that lots of people have under different names, but it's become increasingly the center of my life. Now, why should anybody persist in such a faith as that, looking back on a lifetime at it and out of the world, both of which seem to exhibit more failures than successes in the search for common spiritual grounds? Instead of spending time, as my original talk did, on that question, I'll talk now a bit about how this rhetorological religion entered my life. Only recently have I begun to suspect that new mission, was the direct result of my 2 years as a confused, probing, often troubled Mormon missionary. After 5 or 6 years of reading and questioning and private conference with pious but unorthodox teachers at BYU, heated debates with orthodox and unforgiving authorities, that 20-year-old Wayne Booth, argumentative and increasingly skeptical about many Mormon claims, and even troubled by the unsaintly behavior of many saints, surprised a lot of people by accepting a mission call. By the way, how many of you heard Levi Peterson read part of this yesterday? Oh, goodness. As you listen, just ask yourself, why did he cut out what I don't cut out, and why have I added what he didn't have? And also think about his tone of voice versus mine. There's very, very different tones. I've heard him before. It's much more as if he's trying to rouse skepticism. That boy surprised a lot of people by accepting a mission call. As he put it to skeptical friends at BYU, but never to the church authorities, he was not going out to make converts, not to get people ducked into the baptismal water, but to do good in the world and to start liberalizing the church from within. Did that feel hypocritical? Yes, indeed, at least some of the time. The key moment of decision went like this. The scene is the northwest corner of the BYU farmland where the head sluice gates lie, or lay, the sluice gates that I manipulate as I irrigate the farm, reading my pocket Plato as I wait at the end of the furrows for the water to arrive. Sometimes I go to sleep and with my bare foot in the furrow so it would wake me when the water got there. Now this evening, Professor M. Wilford Polson has happened by and stopped his car nearby. I go to his car, place one rubber-booted foot on his fender, and we start talking. We talk and talk and talk, on through the beautiful sunset, into the twilight, slapping mosquitoes, talking mainly about the church and my doubts. Polson, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You keep leaping ahead into areas you know nothing about. The fact that some church leaders are dishonest or unjust doesn't mean that the church is valueless. Every institution, including every church, has some immoral leaders. Surely you're not going to relapse into the position that because the church claims to be divinely led, and its leaders are clearly not divine, it must be valueless when judged in human terms. Wayne. No, but I don't see any reason to. You shouldn't be looking for reasons to. You should be looking for reasons not to. Here you are, raised in a marvelously vital tradition, surrounded by an astonishing number of good, intelligent people who have found a way to organize their lives effectively. You come along and ask them for reasons to do what they're doing? What you should ask for before giving up anything they offer you is reasons not to go along. Wayne, somewhat more sheepishly. But I just can't stand even sitting in church without speaking up when somebody talks nonsense. Last Sunday they were talking about personal devils, and some of them really believed that stuff. Polson. Well, you know what I've always said when some authority grilled me in Salt Lake City on that one? Of course I believe in personal devils. All my devils are personal. It's so unimportant whether you call it devils or personal quests or temptation or schizophrenia. The 55-year-old professor, owner of the best collection of books on Mormon history, he had taken me into his basement several times to look at these scandalous books that Joseph Smith had available, and thus shaking my faith a good deal. I'm feeling in this conversation, as you can imagine, with this professor, exhilarated beyond description. This is what life can be. This is one of the great times. I'll stay here forever if he'll only go on talking. Polson, what you should be doing instead of trying to undermine other people's belief is discovering beliefs that you yourself can live by. And you'll find that most of them are being taught right now in the church by the people you're attacking. That's why I keep saying, show me a better church. What the church really lacks now, he went on, is devoted men. I'm pretty sure he didn't say anything about women at that point. Men who still are willing to think, not just be carried away with sentimentality. What they really need is a core of missionaries who know everything is wrong about the church and who don't care, because they know that it can be an instrument for good in their hands. Wayne, do you mean to suggest that I should go on a mission? Polson, why not? If you could work not to get the people under the water, but to take them where you find them and help them to grow, why not? Can you think of a better way to spend 2 years than setting out to help other people with no concern about your own welfare or future and no pay? If you worked hard, if you thought hard, and if you could keep from worrying too much about your own reputation, you might make a real difference for a lot of people. Just take, for example, the whole question of charity toward backsliders. Who is that in charge in our present setup? You might ask the same question today. None of the other missionaries will be working on that, and you might. Why not? So at 10 o'clock, they break up, and a few days later, that young man accepts the call. Now, back now in the late 90s, it's clear that he thus landed himself in rhetorical waters, far more turbulent than he could ever have predicted. Even Polson, who'd served as a missionary himself, couldn't have predicted the kind of thing that I was landing myself into. A second-generation Mormon liberal. From day one, the young man had to deal with shock concerning differences between his beliefs and what every missionary believes. His experience in the temple ceremony, I won't go into that, but it was very distressing. Polson had warned me about the fact that it would be distressing, but in those days, you know, there's much more blood and thunder in the ceremony than there is now, and I was almost so shocked that I decided to go back home. But then the young man found himself tracting door to door, struggling to reconcile what the manual said he should teach with what he believed to be the best spiritual food for himself, for his companions, and for prospects who turned up. Now living daily with companions and supervisors who considered what he called the superstitions to be more important than love or charity or any of the other virtues, he found himself inevitably pursuing a practice that he would no doubt have cringed to hear me call rhetorology now. He became not a mere practitioner of persuasion, a rhetor, as we rhetoricians call it, trying to win converts to his views, and not the more mere student of how people persuade, that is, a rhetorician, professional, but a rhetorologist asking, how can I reconcile their rhetoric with mine? He got to be pretty good at some amateur versions of rhetorology, sometimes in ways that his younger self damned as hypocritical. For some reason or other, he didn't get very far in liberalizing the whole church from within, but he did learn how to pray in public in a language that accommodated the literalists without violating his own meditations. He learned how to give sermons that woke some people up, undermined their cliches, and led them to dwell on the central virtues and limits of Mormonism without leading to too many angry attacks against him for unorthodoxy. Well, in my article is going to come out in Sunstone, I go into quite a lot about the cheerful side of things, but then I say that picture of what he learned about dealing with rival rhetorics is much simpler and more cheerful than the picture I find reading over his mission journals, full as they are of vast swings from despair to hope and back again. Only rarely does he talk openly in the daily accounts of the rhetorical problems he faces in dealing with the surrounding orthodoxy. Often the journal reveals conflicts between the gods of scientific truth and the rival gods of moral and political service. If you care about the truth of things, I find him implying, you ought to quit this mission. On the other hand, if you care about human welfare, now or in the future, if you care about helping people, you should continue. Most striking to me now are the ways in which he labors to reconcile diverse views of religion and science. When he reads Creative Evolution by Bergson, for example, a book that then touted by liberal believers, it was recommended to me by one of my professors, his response is that of a would-be believer rescued from the seas of doubt. September 5, 1942. Bergson is magnificent, especially where he is obviously wrong or only guessing. Bergson is righter than most philosophers. Bergson is a man after my own heart. And I go on with quite a lot about that. The scientist in the boy, he'd begun a BYU intending to become a chemist, of course raises doubts. Bergson carries himself away in his enthusiasm, and then I go on why you don't want to believe everything Bergson says. In entry after entry, I find Booth struggling in that way to reduce the distance between religious belief and what he considers rationally defensible belief. Armed with Bergson and Plato and later Jung, and Jung says that he has never known a psychological problem that was not essentially a religious problem, Elder Booth can sometimes, with a clear conscience, liberalize whatever seems ready to be liberalized as it comes his way. September 8th, 42. Last night, Clive Bradford, fellow missionary, and I had a long talk about the church, philosophy, the war, and the missionary system. Brad is an intelligent fellow, original in his thinking. I've had him reading Hawking and Will Durant and James's varieties of religious experience and so on. Now, I'm sure you all recognize that that's the tone of a young would-be wise man spreading his mature harmonies to the world. The best critic of such pomposities was his favorite mission companion, Marion Duff Hanks, who provided brilliant challenges to most of his ideas, both radical and conservative, and who later provided the best possible model of what it means to be a totally devoted, an active yet liberal Mormon. As everybody I've ever talked to about that feels disappointed that Duff my friend Duff didn't become a general authority. As his long year draws, the first year draws to a close, he gets the idea of organizing the liberals. If all the so-called Mormon liberals could organize, some beneficial changes would be wrought. He uses that word, wrought. But then in a long, fascinating paragraph, most of which I'll spare you, he describes the differences among the liberals and concludes that the group who think as I do probably numbers no more than 20 at the most. And of course, this is the right way, and all the others will eventually come to our position, of course. He didn't know how to use irony. Yes, he went on, we liberals are a hodgepodge of malcontents and will probably never get together. What would he think about this meeting tonight? Naturally, Elder Booth felt a lot of guilt about his hypocrisy. Frequently, it almost chokes him. March 1643, in trying to detect any particular theme running through my dreams last night, I find only one. I am a fake and in danger of being found out. One night, I'm back at my irrigation doing my usual half-hearted job, not knowing where to go next nor when the water will get out of control. Next night, I'm claiming 5 pictures in an art gallery as my own that I've stolen. I stalk through my dream, trying to avoid questions about my methods of work, knowing I cannot answer them intelligently. I even forget which are mine, and am in fear that someone will ask me. Another night, I'm a crook going into a high school, and I get discovered, and I have to shoot my way out. You can see just how troubled the young man was. 2 weeks later, he writes, one possibility in explaining these dreams is the essential hypocrisy of my present mission. What I find most reassuring, skipping quite a bit about hypocrisy there, about this missionary record, drawing toward the end here, is the way in which all of that inner turmoil slowly begins, as the 2 years draw to a close, to resolve itself into more aggressive attempts at conscious rhetorology. And I'll quote from one episode, October 2nd, 1943. I neglected to mention here, I believe, as if I were writing to somebody, I'm just writing to myself, the speech I gave at the North Shore Ward last week. I was in my old stride, at my best, perfectly at ease and composed. I yet had them intensely interested all the way. One can tell about such things, and I think that I really made them think. My subject was some of the faults which prevent Mormons from making what they could of themselves. It was never thus expressed, but that's what it was. I gave it to them straight, and I believe there was only one member who did not like it. How could he know? And even he seemed interested. I'm a little disappointed with myself for not having given more such good accounts of myself while on my mission. I hardly ever mention my mission and my opinion of it here in the journal. That is, I suppose, partly because I'm generally quite discouraged about the little I have accomplished. But then he goes back to things that he thinks he has accomplished and successes, and he gets appointed mission secretary, and he goes home and has a glorious farewell. And then he goes on through his homecoming. And then he goes on through life wondering about what that taught him. And I think I have many reasons for gratitude for that experience. One, it kept me from breaking with the church. Most of my liberal friends of that time became academics, many of them, and moved further and further from the church. Some joined other churches, some became atheists, or thought they did. The mission saved me from that. Secondly, it did teach me about this love I have, this worship I feel for this religion of rhetorology, which it seems to me the best academic equivalent there is to love. It means that we listen to other people as we would want them to listen to us. We treat them as brothers and sisters, not as enemies, and we hope in the long run that they will become converted to rhetorology themselves. Thank you very much.
Our final speaker tonight is Toby Pingree. He is an accountant who provides financial and accounting expertise to healthcare providers. He's been living in California for the last 20-some-odd years and recently relocated in Salt Lake. He has a BA from the University of Utah and an MBA from Harvard. He served as a bishop 3 times, mission president in Ecuador, and he is the father to 6 children and has been married for 39 years.
It's kind of sobering standing up here at an hour and a half after the meeting started. We don't even let sacrament meeting go this long anymore, and I feel... I hope I can keep you with me, and we'll have an enjoyable time together. I've enjoyed this group that I have spoken with today. What's that? Can't hear me? Can you now? Can you now? I guess that's that better. Okay. Well. Since accepting the invitation to be a participant in this Pillars of My Faith session, I've been a little uncomfortable at the prospect of speaking here. The first verse of the hymn, A Mormon Boy, goes something like this, and since we didn't sing, I'll try and sing it. Kind friends, as here I stand to sing, how very queer I feel, for now I've made my vow, I feel I don't look quite genteel. I don't feel quite genteel. I don't really know what I'm doing here. Generally, those who have previously participated in the Pillars of My Faith have earned reputations as distinguished college professors, experienced writers, saints who have felt the heat of the church judicial process, or persons who have a long history and involvement in the Alternative Voices LDS community. I don't fit. My life experience has little in common with those predecessors I have named. I am an accountant, a job category with a reputation for being dull and colorless. That bland reputation is exceeded only by the fame of actuaries, morticians, and tax collectors. I'm afraid that in some way I might not say the right thing or measure up. To deal with this insecurity, I plunge ahead, heeding the advice faxed to me yesterday from my son in spade and advising the following. Hope and pray that if you do nothing else on this occasion, you show who you really most deeply are. Forget what anyone might say, think, good, bad, or indifferent, and strive simply to be able to sit down afterward and say to yourself, Toby Pingree made himself known. I offer the following 6 pillars that you may know who I am and what I stand for. Pillar number 1, and some of this will be with apologies to Dale, who stole my thunder. Faith in God who created and directs the course of the universe. The complexity of the world in which we live has convinced me that it has come about as part of a systematic, organized plan. The alternative of random occurrences creating our universe is inconceivable to me. The concept that this plan is the work of a personal God appeals to me, although I can understand why others find non-personal gods acceptable. Joseph Smith and others have taught that the term God is plural, and I find that acceptable. Foremost among the gods I deal with are Heavenly Father and Mother. Also included are God the Son, Jesus Christ, and God the Holy Ghost. The attributes of God are difficult to define and understand, but are virtues and characteristics we seek as we move toward becoming like God. Absolutes like omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, and omniscient have been used to characterize what makes God God. My understanding of Mormon doctrine is that these absolutes do not mean that God can do everything, be everywhere at once, and know all there is to know. He is limited by eternal laws of the universe. It only seems like he can do everything because he is so much more powerful than we are. It only seems like he can be everywhere at once because his influence can be felt everywhere. His knowledge is so vastly superior to what we mortals can imagine that it seems he knows everything. But my experience is that learning is expansive. The more one learns, the more there is to learn. Hence, God must still be learning. As significant as the absolute omnis are in understanding God, however, they are of secondary importance to the core aspects of God's being which relate to me and the rest of humanity. God possesses unconditional love for all his children. He has unlimited mercy to extend to them, and he assures them there will be complete justice exercised on their behalf. Pillar number 2, reality of 2 related gifts from God, the atonement of Jesus Christ and continuous revelation from the heavens. Much has been written in an attempt to explain what the atonement of Jesus Christ was and what it means. I understand that this simple yet sublime act empowers all humanity to escape the ravages of death by providing a resurrection for all. It also provides an escape hatch from those consequences of sins due to our shortcomings and actions. I understand this was completely inspired by love for all who ever lived and will live on the earth, and maybe even the entire universe. And it was an unconditional bestowal on all of us. Yet with this limited understanding, the atonement remains essentially a mystery. I don't know why Christ had to take upon himself the burdens of humanity. Neither do I understand why God, in whom I place all my love and faith, would willingly sacrifice his Son. Did it have to happen? If so, was there no other way? In spite of my lack of comprehension with misgivings about the methods of attaining it, I humbly accept the blessings of the atonement. I'm also grateful that God continually blesses his children with ongoing revelations from the heavens. The voice and influence of the Lord can be sensed in the direction of his church and the world in general. From personal experience, I know that I have had personal, direct messages from heaven. In one case, I was alone on the side of a highway trying to change a tire when a voice came to me as clearly as a blast from a boombox that I was to move from where I was sitting. I responded immediately just seconds before the car crashed down where I'd been. In another case, I struggled in prayer regarding action I had taken as a young military officer in my capacity as a branch president, which offended a church member several ranks higher than I. He was a colonel and I was a brand new lieutenant. I received a clear response that the Lord supported what I had done and no negative consequences would result. Yep. But the most important aspect of revelation is a still small voice I receive which assures me I'm loved, which communicates to me that someone shares the struggles I have in life, and which occasionally gives me direction in my life. Pillar number 3. All God's children are equal in his sight. Nephi taught that all are alike unto God, black and white, bond and free, male and female. The Apostle Peter concluded that God is no respecter of persons, but only after being hammered with the message that Gentiles were to get the gospel as well as the Jews. God loves all equally, wants us all to have equal opportunities to treat one another with respect and fairness. This is a hard truth for folks to assimilate. I know for it took years and a lot of hard knocks for me to shake a prejudiced worldview that came from growing up in a white, prosperous environment where the conventional wisdom was that those who were different were of less worth. My comfort zone of superiority was shattered over many years as I encountered people of diverse backgrounds different from my own. In high school, I learned that blacks did not like to be called the N-word when one of them heard me saying it repeatedly. He had reason to knock my block off, but handled it coolly by simply stating he didn't like me calling his people that name. My mission experience in Central America thrust me into a foreign culture, new language, and all brown people. This helped me come to the conclusion that what others had and may have been different, but was not inferior. An Air Force assignment in Germany and graduate school in Massachusetts exposed me to diversity among even whites. But the major struggle I had with equality of people before God resulted from wrestling with the black problem in the church. I first became sensitized to it in seminary when I heard blacks couldn't hold the priesthood, go to the temple, or be proselytized. I was further confused by a mission field experience when my mission president arbitrarily decided that a member family of several years had Negro blood. He took their priesthood ordinations from them and scratched their temple plans. The fact that others in the branch looked like the family that was dealt with didn't faze the present a bit, although it has troubled me a lot. My concerns for this issue peaked during the civil rights years of the 1960s. Like others, I'm sure many of you here, I struggled with the inconsistencies between church teachings and doctrines and that practice. After extensive reading and study, many discussion groups and personal prayer, I concluded that the policy was a result of cultural influence and historical precedent, not divinely inspired by a revelation from God. I fretted and worried over this until I had a personal revelatory experience which put my mind at ease. It occurred during a high council meeting, which was to be my last as I had taken a new job in a state across the country. The state president did something I had never seen done before when he acknowledged that it was my last meeting, said some very kind things about my efforts as a member of the high council, then asked if I had anything to say. I spoke without prior thought. and spent a few minutes expressing my genuine affection for the men with whom I had associated and the love I had for the job. Suddenly, I was talking about my concerns over the race issue, stating how much it bothered me and my conclusion that I believed it was being treated improperly in the church. As I was speaking, there came to my mind as strong an impression as I've ever had of that nature, which said, in effect, "My son, cease to concern yourself. This is my problem, not yours. Stop worrying about it." My mind was at peace from that moment onward, and I was able to function in a wide variety of church callings without the constant personal struggle over the race matter. A few years later, the issue came up in a different context when I was called to be a bishop. I felt I had to tell the stake president that I would be prepared to give the priesthood a black man under my jurisdiction if one such became a member of my ward and were found worthy. I told him of my belief there was no good cause for denying the priesthood. However, I assured the stake president I would notify him ahead of time of my intent to deviate from the then current church practice so he could release me if he disagreed with my course of action. The stake president swallowed hard on the proposal, but still extended the call because he was convinced the Lord wanted me to be the bishop. That's what he said. My resolve was never tested because I only lasted a year in the job before moving out of the area, and no black people showed any interest in church membership during that time. But 4 years later, the change took place, and he who had assured me that it was his problem, not mine, had resolved it in his way. The issue of all being alike unto God and his being no respecter of persons is still with us. Women are treated as second-class citizens in the church, and no amount of expansively describing the wonderful things the church does for them changes the fact. They are excluded from much church administration, policy-making, and activity simply because they are women. It isn't right and keeps us from measuring up to God's norm of all being alike unto him, for he is no respecter of persons. Pillar number 4. My relationship with my family is the most meaningful segment of my earthly life. My wife, Phyllis, 39 years, and I have developed a relationship which accommodates our differences and allows us to grow together. We are strikingly different in many ways, yet the total trust we have in each other and the unlimited concern we have for one another makes possible the warm, intimate relationship we share. I cannot imagine existence without the assurance of her love for me. As for my children, 4 of whom are here, and only the birth of one son, and the birth of a son to one of them, and a travel in Spain, the other kept them away. We're still at work on how to interact with and build each other. All have chosen different paths in their lives than I have trod. Some of those alternate routes have been easy for me to accept, but others have presented a direction and course which I consider neither appropriate nor prudent. Notwithstanding these conflicts, it is a core belief of mine that I must extend every effort to maintain a healthy, growing relationship with each of my children, one in which we can mutually contribute each other's well-being regardless of how we are currently living. Pillar number 5. The fellowship of good people is a continual source of growth and strength to me. Over my lifetime, I have interacted with wonderful people in many environments: school, mission, work, neighborhood, volunteer organizations, extended family, travel, discussion groups, church organizations, and so on. These relationships have helped me gain appreciation for diversity, see the world from different points of view, help me feel loved and respected by those who are different than I, while I learn to extend the same respect to others. In my daily work, I have the privilege of providing services to people who are generally decent, who appreciate my efforts, and who enrich and contribute to my life. For 40 years, I have had marvelous business associates who have kept me challenged and growing intellectually. Friends from different eras, childhood, mission, college, former church units, and living locations keep reappearing to energize me and renew the relationship. Discussion groups in institutional and informal settings where ideas are freely exchanged and differences respected add a rich dimension to my life. While many of the relationships have become rusty from years of non-use, I still feel the strong bond of devotion exists in most cases. All it takes is an occasion of renewal, and the relationship takes off from the last contact. The pillar of friendship, polished and burnished anew, is still anchored to that bedrock we supported in the past. Pillar number 6. I love the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with all my heart. I consider it as much my church as it was the Prophet Joseph's or his President Hinckley's or anyone else's. It has the power to minister holy, saving ordinances which will bless those who receive them in this life and in the hereafter. It is a vehicle to do much good in the world. It was a blessing to my forebears who cast their lot with it and raised them far above where they would have been had they remained in the old country. It still performs that miracle for those who join the ranks today. My immediate family has been amply blessed by being involved over the years in various church activities. However, in spite of its divine origins, the church is also an earthly institution subject to some of the same maladies that plague all bureaucracies. There are times when the church's professed goal of having individual needs be the primary purpose of the organization is twisted, and the requirements of the institution prevail, regardless of the cost, in terms of human suffering. I painfully recall at least one occasion when I was a presiding church officer that I was responsible for this happening. I officiated the excommunication of a gay Mormon male who desperately wanted to remain in the church, but couldn't assure the bishop's court that he would renounce homosexuality forever. I've seen other unfortunate examples of perceived institutional needs prevailing over the good of individuals. An outstanding Sunday school was released because he had no temple recommend, and it was a stake policy that only recommend holding members could teach. This teacher couldn't get a recommend even though he was worthy because he was waiting for the restoration of blessings after being baptized. I was aware of effective young women leaders being released because they were single, and therefore presumably they were poor examples to the youth. Ditto for women who worked outside the home. I recognize there have to be rules and organizations have to have levels of discipline, but times and circumstances can require different approaches. The need to keep the troops in line was far greater when Johnson's army was approaching than when the hosts of ERA backers were at the gates. In my experience, the church functions best when those who administer it are willing to bend and twist the rules to bless individuals, as the following examples indicate. In Otavalo, Ecuador, stake and ward priesthood leaders don't wear suits and ties, but dress in native ponchos, white shirts and pants, wear their hair in a trench or a pigtail, and beards whenever they choose. Things work just fine. In some stakes and wards in the U.S., there are gay men and women who are quietly living in monogamous relationships and are able to function in the church without being dealt with by priesthood leaders. Don't ask, don't tell. In other places, there are church leaders who are creative in finding church callings for women that allow them to fully participate in all meetings and councils of the units. In some singles wards, single adult women and men home and visit teach together. My observations have been that the love of Christ is present and the church functions better when there are such manifestations of concern for individuals. And I hope for the best for this church I love.